Welcome to Quarantine Zone, a podcast for HBO's The Last of Us. We are your hosts, Andrew Sorsini,
Dwayne D,
and Tosin Anafawakin.
We just watched the first episode of The Last of Us titled When You're Lost in the Darkness. We assume you have as well. Total spoilers ahead. Let's dive into the aftertalk. But first, let's give you some online spots where you can get in contact with us. You can write to us or email us a voice memo at quarantinezonepod@gmail.com. A little convoluted, I know, but that was what was available. You can follow us on Twitter at QZpod. That's a much easier name to remember, handle to remember. And if you add us on your podcatching services like iTunes, please like us and leave us a review. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and what we can do to improve it. All right. So this episode is written by Neil Druckmann and Craig Mazin. Neil Druckmann was the creator of the original 2013 PlayStation video game. And Craig Mazin was the writer, showrunner, and director of Chernobyl. And this episode was directed by Craig Mazin, who also directed and showran Chernobyl. Before we get into our impressions, though, Dwayne, why don't you give us a recap of this episode?
Sure. This is going to be a quick recap, just the bullet points of kind of what happened plot-wise, not any kind of deep dive or anything. So first, we end up in 1968. There is a kind of talk show discussion. Everyone's smoking, and you've got these experts talking about a pandemic. One describes a pandemic like the one we've all dealt with in the real world, an airborne viral pandemic. And another one, he basically says that's not what you have to worry about. We've always won those. What we have to worry about is a fungal pandemic. And he's basically like, we don't have any tools to stop a fungal pandemic the way we do with viruses or bacteria. We simply don't have anything. And while the first one says fungus doesn't live in humans, he's like, well, what if the earth were to warm? And that kind of puts a fantastic bit of foundation down there. So then we fast forward to 2003, where we meet Sarah. She's a young woman. She lives with her father. She's in high school. And she loves him very much, and she's a very endearing person, right? During the day, it's her father's birthday. There is an outbreak and of this new fungal pandemic, and Sarah ends up dying as her family tries to escape. 20 years later, we see a boy in the woods in the outskirts of the Boston, safe zone, and he enters the safe zone, and they test him. And the test comes back that he is positive for this pandemic, this fungal pandemic, and they effectively euthanize him. And that's when we transition to Sarah's father, who we met earlier. His name is Joel. He's alive. He sells drugs and to military people. A group called Fedra kind of runs the world. And he takes on dirty jobs to make money, right? Then we meet Tess. And she is Joel's girlfriend, and she is in a bind. She's for whatever reason, the deal she was going to make doesn't work out, and the people who made the deal with her are worried about Joel hurting them, and so on. But she talks her way out, and she's pretty much of a commanding figure. Then we meet Marlene, right? Marlene is the leader of the local cell of Fireflies. These are the people who are against Fedra, who are the troops that run everything. And she has found Ellie. And her job, according to her superiors, is to get Ellie out of there. When we run into Joel again, he's trying to get out to see his brother out of the sort of safe zone. And we know that it's punishable by death to leave the safe zone. So Joel's on his way out, and he runs into Marlene. And Marlene has had a run-in with the same people who were, messing around with Tess. Except that Marlene is wounded and her squad is gone and she can't take Ellie out. So she contracts with Joel and Tess to get Ellie to this place where her people are. And at that point, they take that contract and they get Ellie out of there. Joel runs into the same soldier he was selling drugs to. And in a sort of like mental flashback to his PTSD when his daughter died, he takes down that soldier and then they kind of flee into the night, into the quarantine zone, and that's kind of where we leave it. So pretty straightforward, not a whole lot of jumping around, no time skips or anything like that, like in some of the other things we've watched. But I think it was pretty compelling to watch.
Yeah, so I was just going to jump to that. So, Dwayne, thanks, and thanks for that fantastic recap, by the way. What were your impressions of this first episode when you're lost in the darkness?
I got to say I loved it. I don't love things easily. And yeah. I really don't like video game adaptations, at least the ones I've seen in the past. I mean, they can be campy, they can be silly, but I don't like think, oh man, I want more of this. This one has promise, and it's mostly because, for me, a lot of video game cutscenes are terrible. So
yeah,
you're watching the video game, and like, you know, it's a video game, so you get suspended in disbelief. You're playing the game, so the animation matters less. But when you just watch them, it's kind of like, ugh, okay. But here, the voice acting. Or the acting, right? It's great. They manage to bring the story to life with you not being the player character. So they're
right.
actually able to take the emotions that you would feel playing, and the actors and the writing are able to display them back at you. And if you've played the game, it feels accurate because you're getting an emotional layout from of the game from people who aren't you. It's an interesting sensation, and I dig it. What did you think, Tosin?
I really enjoyed it too. I think they did a good job laying down the scene and setting the environment. One thing I've been kind of curious is what the pacing will be like in terms of how far they'll proceed from episode to episode, given that we already have a good idea on how the game flows and sort of the general game time it takes, which I think was approximately, in some of the videos that I've seen, playthroughs are like 10 hours, you know.
And those are expert playthroughs, right?
Yeah, those are people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, but they're not dying at all.
But no speed runs either.
Yeah, but generally, like with an expert playthrough, somewhat similar to, you know, what you could potentially see in a show, because you're not, it's not someone who's dilly-daddling around and trying to like figure out where things are, right?
Find every Easter egg, yeah.
Exactly. But I think the pacing was good. I think there were a few things that we can talk about later that were semi-surprises. I thought there were some great nods to the original work of art.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of curious to see how they continue to develop. But I think strong showing for the first episode, ready for the next, to be honest.
Yeah. I absolutely love this. I've got it.
So you wanted to love this, and I guess what you're saying is you were not disappointed.
I was not disappointed, but I also have to. I'm going to reiterate a little bit of what we talked about in our 100 episode, on our last episode, our pre-series episode, because I feel like it's important to have that context. I played this game when it first came out. I did not play all the way through, so I admittedly am not entirely caught up with the entire play of the game, but I played, I'd say, about 2/3 of the way, and the first 10-15 minutes of this game was so impactful for me, hit me so hard that I had to put the controller down, and I couldn't play for 3 months. And it's essentially the prologue that we see in this episode that takes us right up to Sarah's death, to Joel's daughter, Sarah's death. It just hit me so hard. I was a young a parent at that time. And so it just really struck me to my core. And I have to tell you that watching this episode, watching the first, you know, 20 minutes or so, the Sarah prologue, all of that feeling came back. It was like, it was almost like PTSD. It was like triggering. And I found myself when Sarah is shot, I had that like a rush of emotions, and I was crying, and I had to like pause the game and stop and like, you know, blow my nose. And I was a mess. I was a horrible mess. But all the while I was watching it, I appreciated how faithful the adaptation was to the original video game. And faithful in all the best ways. Yet also, I loved how they fleshed out, I think you mentioned it, Dwayne, how they fleshed out the stuff that wasn't beat for beat from the game too. And I love, like you said, that opening prologue, which is this perfect way to set up the backstory of what this, you know, it's like a visual scene version of what you would see in a lesser made sci-fi movie where you see text scrolling up on the screen. You know, yeah. Humans, yeah,
you
lost
even
the...
have that in games as well too,
like, yes.
I believe I don't know if either of you guys played The Division, where there's similar viral spread. Uh-huh. At the beginning there's you know, screens of text of what's going on, setting the time, setting the location. I think they did a very solid job calling that out and kind of pointing out some of the differences, especially for people who are not familiar with the content.
Right. In fact, why don't we just get into talking about some of these individual things? But the short version is that, yes, I absolutely love this. I'm thrilled to see where this goes. Since I didn't finish my actual gameplay of the original game, when this episode ended, I watched it again, and then I watched a no commentary playthrough of the game up until the point where this episode ends. So I feel like I'm all caught up on the source material and this episode. So let's talk about some of these individual things, and let's start with that opening scene.
Yeah, the way they fleshed out Sarah was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
The, you know, in the video game, you see her give the watch and she explains that she got the money, whatever. But instead of like having her explain it, they do what good stories do best. They show it, right? They show her going in. And it's one of these three things, I think, that kind of like flip the story on its head, right? So at first you think she's stealing from her dad to go have fun and do the kinds of things that teenagers do. But she's doing it to fix his watch on his birthday. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And watches are significant because in this show, time is significant. Right. You've got time cards to show us when it is 1968, 2003, 20 years later. We get introduced to Joel through his alarm. Sarah steals and fixes his watch. The cookies finish on a buzzer.
We're constantly seeing time imagery, even when she goes to the watchmaker and the watchmaker's wife sends Sarah out to the street. She pulls down a shade and you see like a visual giant clock ticking essentially in their shop window. It's this constant reminder that we are on a time frame and the clock is ticking, and it's literally the representation of what screenwriters call the ticking clock, like the ticking time bomb.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's like, it's also random. Like, I don't know why it was important that it was 2:16 when Sarah woke up during the outbreak. I don't know why, you know, they do show us a sign when that kid with the sneakers is brought into the Boston safe zone. It's a sign that shows that if you're bitten on your neck or whatever, it takes 15 minutes. If you're bitten in your like arm or midsection, it takes 2-something hours. If you're bitten on your knee, it takes 24 hours. And he's got a leg bite, so we know that he's been walking post-bite. So time is a thing. But what I really loved was things like seeing her take that money and then using it to fix his watch, something he needed to do for himself anyway, but he wasn't going to do. Seeing that kid euthanized was another way that it flipped itself on its head. Because normally when you find a kid who survived something in the zombie thing, people take him in and he becomes like a character. But in this case, they straight up like took him out, like that family in the first episode of The Man in the High Castle. Like they just like, oh, we're going to give you a little prick with this and you'll be fine. Yeah. Like it was a poison if you died.
You know, honestly, I didn't quite get that. It was only this on the second rewatch that I realized, because I thought, oh, they're going to give him some sort of cure. And it was, or some sort of, I don't know, something. But I didn't realize until the second time around that he was infected and that they were euthanizing him.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like Schindler's List when like, there's just like this pile of bodies, and Joel reaches in and picks up a body and just like throws it, like with how they had all these bodies just hanging out on wheelbarrows, that kind of thing. It was It was
interesting. On that point, you know, I think initially when I saw the kid, I initially thought he was a zombie because of the way he was walking.
Right.
And then they you know, played a little bit with how his pacing went, and then they made it look like he wasn't one, right? And then also providing him, like, the badge. And then, you know, they showed us him getting scanned and it turning a particular color. And so the question is, like, what does that color mean? Is that safe? Is that good?
Yeah, I mean, red always means bad, but because of the way we've been told stories for so long, especially zombie stories, I feel like we thought that, okay, maybe red means okay. Mm-hmm. And we didn't see the face of the person when he showed her the red thing, right? So there wasn't like he saw red and he shook his head or anything like that. He just showed it to her. And then she hides her expression. We don't really know what's going on in her face, but the person he's talking to, she's like, okay. But then the trick is when she says, what if we found your favorite food? Like, in this world, you're going to find someone's favorite food? I don't know.
Right.
Like, it's not like he's like, oh, I like, you know, pistachio ice cream. And she's like, oh, we have that, you know. So that's a thing.
It was all the empty promises to this kid.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, and the last thing they flipped on his head was Snow White and the Huntsman. So, like, in lots of shows, somebody from on high tells a person, you got to take out X, Y, or Z, right? It's an innocent.
Yeah.
And that innocent is, you know, the gun is pointed at them or the knife is raised. And for whatever reason, that huntsman, it's a soldier, it's whatever, they don't do it. Go ahead, run, get out of here. And they shoot in the air or something, right? He straight up was like, okay. And he shot them.
Yeah.
And that was like, are you really going to shoot him right now? Or is that really what's happening? And he did it. And I think they just flipped the Snow White and the Huntsman kind of motif right on its head. And the interesting thing is, in Snow White, if the Huntsman killed Snow White, that would be the end of the story, right?
Yeah.
But here, the Huntsman, the soldier, he kills the innocent. He kills Sarah, right? And Sarah means princess, so, you know, wrap your head around that.
Oh, interesting.
So he kills Sarah, but that's the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
So instead of, like, killing Snow White being the end of the story, he kills Sarah, that's the beginning of the story, at least for Joel. So, I don't know, I think all these things are great. Meeting Sarah was great. Maybe we'll see her again in a flashback, maybe not. Whoever was playing Sarah, Nico Parker, I think is her name.
Yeah.
She, I mean, like, that performance was very serious for a very short time. Yeah. The show is showing us, whether it's Sarah or the boy in the sneakers, people that you might be endeared to may not survive.
Yes, yes. And it's nice. I think it's important to reinforce that that sense of subverting your expectations in this show. Like, we got it. We get it from playing the video game. We know what the impact of that. But I love that they are saying right off the bat, you know, there's kind of like an unwritten rule in screenwriting that you don't kill children or pets because they're...
Yeah, you want the dog to survive in Independence Day. You're like, yeah, the dog made it, you know?
But they're like, here, they right off the bat, they're like, you know, nothing is sacred. Some of these characters have to die because it's necessary. And in Sarah's case, it's necessary because the military, they're not Fedra at this point, military shoots her. And in 20 years on, it's important to kill this kid because he could be infected and infect the entire community.
Right. So. It's an unyielding, unflinching military situation. Whether it's the military dealing with the U.S. Army or whoever was in Texas at 2003, or what they become in the form of Fedra, they just they're hanging people in a public square,
right?
A public square that's like known for freedom, like that's like Paul Revere's spot,
right?
It's Boston.
It's important also that I think. Important to note that this video game was created in 2013, a couple years after 9/11, also, and the militarization of Homeland Security. So you see that influence as well. You see the influence of the idea of a militarized state or a state heading towards militarization in our real world, and they just, I feel like they took that in the video game, they took that idea and just extrapolated it to its extreme, and that's what we're seeing here in this, in the foundation of the video of the adaptation.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in sort of many cases, you do see that with the setting of the time and elements around. So especially in that flashback where you're in school, you see the lessons that are being taught, mm-hmm, how mm-hmm. they're being taught, as well as, you know, of course, the image of George Bush as president,
right,
classroom.
Although he had been the president, the governor of Texas, so that image might have been there for a long time.
True.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I think it's interesting that we talk about time as an element that they showed us throughout the course of that sort of opening prelogue, mm-hmm, and there's mm-hmm. that concept of for Joel, his watch has stopped. His watch is something that is not that he himself has kind of lost track of time, and things have always kind of stayed the same. And Joel himself as a character is always losing track of time. He's always behind. He forgets the cake. Right?
He is what we call an event. He's an event. He has event time. So he doesn't think of life in terms of clocks. He thinks of life in terms of things to do. And sometimes he forgets those things to do. Whereas his daughter is definitely more a clock time person.
Yeah, and so he always seems to sort of be behind the clock or the eight ball, so to speak. And so at the point where she provides him a watch that's working, it sort of resets that whole process. Mm-hmm. And now he is interconnected with all the other elements of this world, which are time dependent, right? And so it's interesting that we note later on, 20 years later, that the watch has stopped. It's no longer it's broken. He's no longer connected to this sort of drive via time. He's still in this sort of mist where he's, as you mentioned, event driven.
Right.
But now, as we kind of close that episode, now he's kind of being forced and driven to reconsider what time means and reconsider, you know, this progression of trying to take this lady from point A to point B. It's also interesting, something else that also really interests me about the perception of Joel in the show as compared to the game is, on some regards, some length, it seems like he has gotten over the death of Sarah, his daughter, right?
Right. You see that when they're sorting out the bodies and he's working with that soot-covered woman, and she sees the body of the child, and she's like, I can't bury this child. And he's like, he doesn't think twice about it, because he has been through the ringer on this, and he's had 20 years of trauma about this, and has gone through the other side, and is this sort of this cold person.
But that's what you think when he throws that kid in the fire. But that's not actually what happens, because when he's presented with the sort of like a situational memory of having a soldier point at him while he's in charge of taking care of a young woman, he is back in that moment again.
Right. No, I think that's the inflection point that snaps him back into the, it is a triggering event for him that takes him out of the sort of coma that he was in, this living day to day experience that he was in, to I now have to take care of this young person who cannot take care of themselves.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And I think
they're not equipped.
That'll be the interesting to see as it develops, because one of the things that the game clearly starts off with is this drive to stay connected to the past, where, you know, he's wearing his watch mm-hmm. that clearly mm-hmm. doesn't work. He has all these memories of his daughter that he keeps very close to his chest, while really disconnecting from anything that resembles that sort of relationship or or maybe taking a step further, anything that resembles creating a new relationship with another individual, right? And so that's kind of the perspective that I take from the game, where he's just like, nope, I don't want to be with this girl. I don't want to do this mission. Right. I really am only connected to my brother, to Tess. Why are we doing this? And it seems, to me, it seems like what the show is setting up is kind of bridging that gap even at a greater pace, and also not showing that level of disdain. You know, he beats her up and is looking at his bloody knuckles. He's looking at her. He's heard that she is infected, but he just kind of goes along. In the game, what happens at that scene is, I believe he pulls his gun out at her and is pointing the gun at her and telling Tess that they should kill her, right?
Yeah.
We don't really get that sort of moment of weakness, I'd say. That's something that's interesting to me.
It's an interesting difference. I do think that because we're told, you know, that you got so many hours depending on where you bit, whatever, and she's been, you know, she shows him a bite that's healed up.
Yeah,
it takes weeks to heal things
up.
Right.
Yep.
You get a bad thing. I mean, there's obviously the raised keloid of the scar, but it's not like it's scabbed or it's pussy or anything like that. Like, it's healed up.
Right.
And I think in that moment, he's got a couple motivations. One of them is he does want to find Joel. And he makes it clear earlier to Tess that, you know, the Fireflies usually have surplus or stolen, you know, Phaedra stuff, which is really
Tommy.
The kind of thing that will get them.
Tommy,
yeah,
his brother.
Yeah, he wants to find Tommy's brother. Did I say?
Joel.
Yeah, well, he's talking to Tess.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So he's talking to Tess, and he's like, look, those guys have, like, the good stuff. They have the stolen Phaedra stuff. That'll definitely get us through the soup to Tommy. So yeah. I need that. And the battery that they were going to get for their car, it just doesn't work. It was a crap battery.
Right.
It was bullshit.
Right.
So he's like, I got to find Tommy. I got to get to Tommy. She's my ticket to Tommy. And then she's an innocent, and I did what I had to do to protect her. And now she's showing me that she was bit, but the wound seems healed. And we got
to
go.
You know, and Tess is also saying, like, saw it. I don't think he saw it.
Maybe Tess saw it. I mean,
Tess
we saw
is the only one who saw it. Tess and us, he was still looking at the guy he's punching and looking at his fist.
And it was dark. It was dark too. But when we see it, there's definitely a kind of confirmation that, okay, she's different. Because the boy has a 24-hour or whatever wound on his knee, and they take him out.
Right.
So this was all very interesting, because then Tessa had been scouting where they could leave that day. And so she's like, we got to go. They're all coming. And then he just basically grabs the rifle from the soldier he killed or took out or, you know, put into a coma. And then they leave. So I feel like it all happened kind of in the moment. But I feel like it was orchestrated fairly well enough. In like a good way of transcribing sort of like the freneticness of playing a video game to the freneticness of what happens in a television or a serial. Like, you can't kind of describe everything, but you can show why he made the decisions that he made. And I was this is where I like the series, because they're not doing it word for word from the,
sure.
You know, some things are the same, but they're really using the medium of television to tell the story in a relatively modern way. And I think that's pretty powerful.
I think that we're going to see a lot more of that conflict as things settle down a little bit in the beginning of the next episode.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I do think that there's still a bit of a drive to – I think, as you mentioned, there he was mainly caught up in that moment. And I think as he pulls back –
yeah, he's going to have to be like, what the hell's going on with you? And she's going to have to explain what the hell's going on with her.
Right.
And, yeah. And all that stuff, you know. Also, she's a post-pandemic baby. Because she's not 20, or at least we don't think she's 20.
Right. She's like 14, maybe?
Yeah, she's 14 in the game or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the beginning of the show talked about how the fungus would have to adapt. Now, we also talked about how humans had adapted to viruses. So the idea that she's a human who has something that allows her to adapt to the virus, to the fungus, is kind of like a full circle for me. In the beginning, the bald epidemiologist was saying, yeah, humans adapt to this stuff. And, you know, the other guy was agreed. Yeah, humans adapt to this stuff, but we don't adapt to fungi. And now she seems to have an adaptation that allows her to manage a fungal infection. So this is that's pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Circle.
So one area that I noticed that it was different. We've chatted a little bit about this offline, but it's character adaptations. And so, you know, one of the things that we noted is I think the choice of Sarah, amazing. I think Nico Parker knocks it out of the park. Mm-hmm, and kind of, to be honest, kind of sad that even though I knew that she would only be short-lived in that portion, kind of wanted her to remain the daughter for a while, because I think that relationship, you could really feel that relationship on screen, at least for me.
I mean, maybe they'll soap opera it and they'll be like, in season two, you see like, a mechanically alive version of Sarah who's like a baddie, you know?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about...
I thought Marlene was Sarah for a second when I first saw the shot of her. I'm like, sure, that's not Sarah. With like holding her gut. And then I was like, no, that's not Sarah.
I was thinking about, I think it's very important that Sarah be dead, because it's really the fulcrum
it's the cornerstone memory that
is the cornerstone memory for Joel. Is, exactly. So I for that reason, I almost,
thank goodness it's not network TV, because she'd be back.
Right. And for that reason, I almost don't think that it would be helpful to have a flashback scenes with Sarah, because I feel like that experience was so traumatic that if we were to go back and have flashback scenes before Sarah was killed,
it would
lessen the impact that it had on Joel, and in turn on us
be good for me too, because I have a little girl who doesn't look too different from Sarah, and it was pretty. I wasn't crying the way you were, Andy, but it was pretty painful to see that whole situation go down.
Yeah.
It was, whew. And mine's only three. She can't, like, you know, steal my watch yet. But still.
I think we will get those flashback scenes.
You do?
They kind of showed.
People are going to clamor for her to be back on screen, too.
I think if you watch some of the upcoming scenes, there were some in there.
So. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yep. So I think that's good.
You cheated.
But
I think people would clamor for her to be there. And, you know, she probably filmed them all at the same time.
Sure.
So that's a thing. But I think it's incredible that she could give such life to such a character in such a short way. This is a little bit, you know, like, think about Sean Bean playing Boromir and Ned Stark. You're like, oh, yeah, he's so, like, you know, noble, whatever. Oh, he died. But, like, Sean Bean had a whole movie to do that, and as Boromir, and he had a whole 9 episodes to do that as Ned Stark. She had like 17 minutes or half an hour, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But the most impactful half an hour of the series, because it really is Joel's cornerstone tragedy.
It's like Up.
Yes, exactly. It's like Up.
I was actually kind of interested. Uh-huh. One of the things that I wasn't sure that they were going to do with this episode, I was like, you know, there's several points in the game where you think would make a satisfying way to end an episode. And I could imagine an hour-long episode, or maybe even less, 40-something minute episode, that ends with her death. Like, I could see that ending with her death. Right. And then the words, Last of Us, and that's the end of the episode.
I could see that happening. The only problem is that people would be confused. Like, did she really die? Because I feel like that happens in every single, like, it happens in Westworld, it happens in Game of Thrones. It's like, when someone dies, unless it's like Ned Stark's head rolling, they're like, are they really dead? You know? Mm-hmm. And you're waiting a week to see the really dead. And they're just like, no, she dead. She gone. And now it's time to move on. And that's a lot what The Last of Us is about. It's about moving on. In fact, the whole idea of Ellie is like, how do we move on from this pandemic? How do we rebuild? And how is Joel going to rebuild his life and trust? Pedro Pascal, what's with him playing the lone wolf and cub? Yeah, lone wolf and cub. What is that?
I was thinking I'm about that he too.
He didn't have a puppy in Wonder Woman.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the lone wolf and cub dynamic, and so like,
give me some other shows that you like with that aside from Raised by Wolves.
Well, a Mandalorian, obviously, that's the obvious choice. Mm-hmm. But you know, and I've seen it throughout media over many years, but I would have to say, like, immediately comes to mind Mandalorian because it's so recent, recency bias there. But just that.
I mean, if it's Lone Wolf and Cub, isn't it not a Lone Wolf?
Isn't it what? No, no. I mean, Lone Wolf.
If you have a cub, you're not alone anymore.
Right, but being that this is a character who is reluctant, who reluctantly has to take care of this young defenseless,
anti-hero.
Yes, anti-hero, exactly. And that's clearly who Joel Miller is. That's who the Mandalorian is. You know, I just love that dynamic. There's something very appealing about that dynamic for me. I love seeing when you're lost in the darkness, look for the light. It's like a mantra throughout the game that represents the fireflies. I love when Joel encounters that firefly guy who's in the marketplace, and he says to him, the firefly guy says to him, you know, I don't know, but if you're when you're lost in the darkness, and Joel says, if you tell me to look to the light, I'm going to punch you in the face.
Yeah.
I love because that's also what I loved about this is also subverting expectations for people who have played the game. There's a little bit of both. There's a little bit of telling the
story. How do you keep it faithful? At the same time, you have to deliver something new, which is something that offline you and I have talked about at length. You know, a lot of adaptations.
Yeah.
Sometimes they just spring for the new. They're like, we already have the audience of the book or whatever source material. Now it's time to get a new audience. We're going to go with whatever. And that, frankly, is what happened with The Walking Dead. They kind of like went and Game of Thrones, right? They kind of went away from the story that people knew. So
maybe
it's inevitable, but right now it's good times.
Let's shift topics a little into adaptations in general. When it comes to an adaptation, and when it comes to adaptations that are so slavishly faithful to their source material,
like the Harry Potter books,
like, well, I've only read one Harry Potter book, so I don't really
the first Harry Potter movie was basically they took the book and turned it into a screenplay.
Really?
But yeah, and you're like, your eyes are dropping as you watch it because it's like not engaging at all. Unless you're like a very small person.
I'll say, like, here's a prime example. When Zack Snyder adapted the Watchmen graphic novel into the movie, I feel like he did, like, there were scenes and shots that were frame for frame exactly what were in the comic books. And yet, when you come to the end of that movie, I felt, okay, I was told a story that is
climactic.
Yeah, but there was something that left me a little cold. Like I felt like the it was kind of a slavish adaptation, but for some reason it was lacking the spirit, the heart. There was some indescribable factor that he wasn't able to capture. And I think
I feel like that happened with Thor and Love and Thunder too. They would show you like images from the Gore Butcher the God series, and then at the end of the movie, you were like, "I guess that was okay," as opposed to like, "Oh, that was so great! It reminded me of the comic," you know?
Right. But here, I feel like here's a situation where they got it right, I'm still trying to parse in my mind what is the difference between what Zack Snyder did for Watchmen and what Craig Mazin and Neil Druckmann did here for this series. Like, why is it working so well?
I have an idea about this.
Yeah.
I think it comes down to this. So, you know, Pedro Pascal is not the guy who plays Joel in the video game. You know, he looks like him, but he looks like Pedro Pascal. And, you know, Nico Parker is not the same Sarah. She's not blonde.
Sure.
But I think what they managed to do and what makes an adaptation like this work is that the chemistry is there, even if the characterizations are not hyper accurate to the original. And obviously, in the fandom, this is always going to be controversial, right? I want canon accurate this and canon accurate that is what people say online. I think what you have here is canon accurate when it comes to the spirit of the story, but they're going to go with the people they think who can deliver that. Because again, when you're playing the video game, sure. the emotions are all sure. wrapped up inside you. Some people are cold hearted and they're just like trying to like, you know, speed, you know, do a speed run through the game. And some yeah. people are like, oh my God, I'm so anxious. I have to pause it. I have to go to bed. I have to do this tomorrow, whatever. And I think these actors have to take the work of the writers and transmit those emotions in a way that, you know, is rendered for you. And I think they chose actors that could do that. I'm pretty interested in seeing what happens with Marlene. I feel like she had a very strong and, you know, kind of, you know, lawful good kind of way of looking at her role. And, you know, when you look at Tess, you know, Tosin, you were saying before the show how Tess seems a little different. She's a little less overtly hardcore in the in this rendition than she was in the video game. And I got to say, I think that's true. But I think it's because when you're doing a live action, you know, adaptation, you have to kind of tone things down. Just like the first X-Men movie, people didn't love it, but they loved the look of it. They loved how it felt. And, you know, the X-Men were not wearing the yellow in that movie. You know what I mean? They were wearing black with yellow tones. So they kind of toned it down so it seemed more like what a person in reality would say and how they do it. So she's, you know, Tess is, you know, she's like kind of like calming down the people who are about to beat her up in the chair. She's like calming down Joel. But she's all in all those cases, she's in charge, even if she doesn't look it. And that's like the spirit of what Tess was in the games.
Yeah, I get that. I just would love to have seen Tess be the one to take out the guy who stole her money and battery. She had this epic line yeah. where she's like, hey, you don't have to, like, don't worry, Joel's not going to hurt you. I wanted the reaction to be like, oh yeah, but Tess, I am the one who's going to hurt right. you. It's kind of like in the game.
You don't have to worry about Joel. You have to worry about me. That would be yeah. like what you wanted from Tess.
Exactly. And was it? I couldn't tell. I don't remember. Was it Tess? The Tess at times was also a bit more shocked. Like she was shocked to see the shell on the wall. Was it yeah. also Tess the one who asked Joel to take the body out? Was that Tess? Or is that just another lady? I cannot recall.
Oh, it was another lady.
That was like, another lady.
I can't do it. Take a body out. Yeah.
Covered yeah. lady.
There's another lady. But
yeah. And so Tess yeah. is she's still. I think we still do see some of her strengths. She's the one yeah. kind of pushing them to keep going. She still is that leader. Yeah. But I do like that. I think for me, I did really appreciate how just innately badassery that she was. Granted, one of the things that you notice in this in that's different in adaptation, right? Rather than you being actually the player and having to kind of follow the story, you know, Joel is really more the one of the primary leads, and so you now rather than you now need to kind of follow it from his eyes. I noticed the camera did still leverage a lot of like third character perspective, a lot of older over the shoulder uh-huh. shots. Same thing uh-huh. that you saw.
I noticed that too.
Yeah, so I was like, oh yeah, but you still do. I can see how they'd want to make Joel be a bigger driver than being more passive like you are when you're the one playing the game.
Right. Right.
I will say that I think I can't remember to what extent Marlene's role is in the rest of the video game, but her role is bigger here in the first episode than it was in the
beginning of the game.
In the beginning of the game, yeah. So, yeah.
She kind of reminded me of one of the like half boob women from Why the Last Man.
The Amazon women, right?
Yeah, the Amazon women. She's like, I'm tough and I'm in charge and I follow orders and this is, you know, this is my extremist way of doing things. And I like that. But yeah, Marlene's role was interesting because she facilitated the connection between Ellie and Joel, and she did it without a lot of ceremony. There wasn't like, oh, Ellie, give me a hug or whatever. She was kind of keeping Ellie prisoner. And then she like basically told Ellie what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And then when it didn't happen, because she lost her squad and she was bleeding out and her, you know, number two in command had no ear.
Right.
She's like, you got to go with them. We'll give you whatever we want. And it was just very transactional. She is trying to fulfill her objective and she knows she can't do it. So rather than her Ego sort of take over and like do the kind of thing where like, you know, Rambo wraps his arm up and then continues the fight. She's like, I got to regroup and I can't do that and still do what I'm supposed to do. So she sends her out. But because of that, because she took out the person who had locked up Tess and was kind of beating her up, because she you know, basically connected Ellie and Joel, she becomes this connective tissue that can be brought back in other episodes. Which is going to be interesting because she's got what the one thing Joel and Tess don't have. It's backup.
Right. Equipment, yeah, support.
What's pretty interesting, though, is she's, at least so far, the one character we know who's reprising her role, right?
Right. Kind of cool. So this is Merle Dandridge, who's playing Marlene, who voiced the original character in the 2013 video game. And she's kind of like video game royalty because she also plays Alex Vance in the Half-Life 2 series and Half-Life 2 and Half-Life Alex. So this woman is a major character in at least two of the greatest video games of the last 20 years.
So. Yeah, she's like AAA.
Yeah.
She's getting it done. And it's great to see her on screen too, you know? I think it, just like when we saw Katie Sackhoff on screen in The Mandalorian, she had voiced Bo-Katan in the Clone Wars. We see her there. I think both of those actors, they've pretty much like, you know, when you see them in real life, you're like, that just fits. It's not like they've got a face for radio. Like they work it, you know? So it's good.
Right. I wanted to mention before we start to wrap this up, I wanted to mention the main title sequence, which I really loved, which is, I guess, you know, I've read online also, like a lot of people's opinions of this is kind of the stock HBO.
Oh, it's like Game of Thrones. It's like, I'm going to spread out over this map. You know,
right?
I even think that American God did it too with the Yggdrasil tree.
Yeah,
like, I'm gonna spread out across this thing. It was cool back in 2012, but like now it's like, eh.
But I kind of dug it. I like the idea of representing this because it both in a way it represents this fungi spreading across the nation, with the fungi manifesting itself as cities and other landmarks. And finally, at the very end, manifesting itself as Joel and Ellie. But it also represents the concept of this fungus spreading across the nation as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I dug it. Yeah. And the fact that they stuck to the Gustavo Santaolalla theme from the video game. Just loved it.
Sounds like he's working on this show.
So yeah, he's
making some new, you know, some he's adapting his own music for it, so that's pretty good.
Any last thoughts about this in general before we give our audience members some ephemera, some extra textual connections?
No, I'm good.
Tosin?
Yeah, no, I think for the most part, you know, once again, solid episode, didn't feel as long as it actually was. Running time of like an hour and a half, right?
Yeah.
80 minutes, yeah.
And so, yeah, definitely ready for the next one.
Yeah. Oh, me too. I am so stoked.
If we weren't doing this, I would have bunched them up and watched them as a mega movie.
Yeah. And I think maybe, you know, just to circle back to the Watchmen thing, I think maybe that's one of the things, one of the advantages of the series format as opposed to a feature film is that there's so much more time to sort of relax and breathe and have these character moments. Yes.
If you think about it, it takes about 8 hours to read like a novel, right? Maybe 12. Yeah. And we know now, ever since when this game came out, when Game of Thrones came out, and before that, when Band of Brothers came out, novels do better as limited series or like, you know, a 10 episode run or whatever. Here you have a 9-hour video game and 10-hour video game, and it'll do better as a series. It's what makes this adaptation of a video game so much more interesting than almost every adaptation of every video game ever, which just becomes a movie that always has some level of camp. There's so much camp in these video games that they're actually, they build it into the film on purpose.
Yes.
like with musical cues or like whatever. And so treating this like a prestige, you know, drama,
yeah,
allows them to kind of bring that depth, and we need depth, so that's good.
Yes, but I also think, you know, arguably 2013's The Last of Us was one of the really first prestige video games that could stand on its own as its own narrative. And I feel like, mm-hmm. like adaptations of video games that had come before, like Tomb Raider or
Left 4 Dead or Dead or Alive. It's like, oh yeah, yeah, we're, it's like fighting games or like, you know, picking up, you know, like MacGuffin games.
Yes.
This is literally like a plot line.
Exactly. Like, exactly. There wasn't like a running narrative, like a running arc that ran through the entire, those entire games that had like this running narrative. You know, I think arguably it took a while. Like, I think when Tomb Raider rebooted with the Crystal Dynamics games, then they did build in this running narrative, and then those games were adapted into the recent Tomb Raider movies. But again,
those fell flat, though.
Yeah, they fell flat. So yeah. I think,
yeah, I mean, you did have was it Castlevania? I mean, you have some things in animation, which is a little different, but Castlevania,
yeah,
you know,
a bit less of a leap because a video game is already a type of animation. So to move it to an animation is a thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like if they would have screwed this up, I would have been incredibly disappointed.
I mean, we've spent years talking about how video game adaptations don't work, and you've been like, I'm waiting for one to work. I'm waiting for one to work. You got to do something different. This is the different thing. The different thing is to do it as a TV show. The different thing is to choose a video game that isn't a fighting game or like a... Left 4 Dead, like something that actually has a plot already, and take that and move it. Now, they tried that with Uncharted. It didn't work.
Right. Which is also a Neil Druckmann game.
Neil Druckmann. But it's also they tried a feature film. So taking that narrative, trying it as a series. You know, if this works, we might see Bioshock.
I would love to see that. Well, yeah, they did try it with Halo.
They've tried so many things with Halo.
Yeah.
And none of it's worked.
None of it's stuck.
TV doesn't like a mask, and Master Sergeant lives in a mask. The only character that's ever gotten away with wearing a mask for most of their screen time is Darth Vader.
Mandalorian.
Oh, that's true. He's on the heels of Darth Vader.
That's true.
No, I mean, I think here's the main problem, I think, is often I think the driving factor is let's do this for the fans, rather than create an adaptation that's worthwhile of just being a form of media, let's just try and push it directly for the things that the fans want, and also let's just go all out on, you know, the action rather than really thinking about what's the story we're trying to tell.
Drama,
and investing.
This is a zombie story. There's a million zombie stories, but it's based in a family more than it is anything else. The Walking Dead started out like that, but like in pretty short order, everyone in the family was dead except for Carl and Sheriff Grimes. And then within a few seasons, they were gone too, right? So it's like you got to stick with the core thing. You got to have your core Scoobies, and in this case, it's the Lone Wolf and Cub, and they got to stick together so you can really build that attachment to them. And they're going to do that because the story does that, but they're also going to take their time and do it over the course of 10 episodes or so. And that's going to keep us interested. You know, they could still go off the rails.
Let me ask you a quick question here, Dwayne, because you just recently went through a watch through of all of The Walking Dead, or you have been watching through all of The Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. And I know it's early. We've only seen one episode of The Last of Us, but, and since they're both sort of like essentially zombie.
Post-apocalyptic zombie.
Yeah. How would you compare what you've seen of The Walking Dead from The Last of Us so far?
So let's start by just saying The Walking Dead is a very conventional zombie story, right? You have slow zombies. It's about a bite, maybe a scratch. Scratches aren't even a thing, really. Like, if the blood gets in your face, you're not going to turn. It's really about that bite. You can lop someone's arm off if they get bitten, and they'll probably be okay. And it really comes down to how terrible the humans are, right? This is very, this is like the prototypical, it's the quintessential zombie story, right? This, and I think if you want to go look at Fast Zombies, you can go to 28 Days Later. Those two things, just that's what they do. But when it comes to what's happening in The Last of Us, I think a big part of that is the focus, like the title says it too. It's the focus on these two humans feeling like they're the last humans on Earth. Everyone else has gone berserk. And in addition to that, the fungal nature of the infection is new and different. Just like when 28 Days Later showed up with these running around zombies. And the challenges are different. Are the spores up? Get your masks on in the game. And in this case, you gotta we'll see what they do with like the tendrils. But it's set up well enough to show that there is a kind of a higher power, and that's the fungus, right? Mm-hmm. The fungus is gonna do what the fungus is gonna do. The Walking Dead, it was almost meaningless, right? It was nihilistic. This is not nihilistic. It starts with hope also.
Yes.
Because Ellie is hope. So
yes.
You know, it is an escort mission, classic video game trope escort mission. But the idea is Ellie is the hope. If she's been bitten and we can find out what's up with her, we can do what we need to do. And that's a key difference, I think. So The Walking Dead has no hope. It's Cormac McCarthy, right? Whereas this this totally has hope, and it's doesn't have a sprawling ensemble this so far, right? It's obviously got some great characters, but it's really like it's clear that the focus is on Joel. And it's going to grow into Ellie. I wouldn't call her the focus this episode. She's the subject, but she becomes a focus, I would imagine. And so I'm you know, cautiously optimistic that they can continue to hold that down.
All right, let's get into briefly before we close off this episode, what we call ephemera here, which are links and extra textual connections that will help you enhance the enjoyment of the episode. And I think the main thing we want to focus on here, I'm going to kick it to you, Dwayne, about the fungus that's at the heart of this story.
Yeah, so the fungus is called Cordyceps. It's a real-world fungus that messes with ants and other insects. The fungus is the same thing that the game's fungus was based on. The fungus changes ant behavior so that the ant behaves in a way that allows the fungus to use the ant as a host and mm-hmm. reproduce better, right? There's another thing that's like this. It's called toxoplasmosis, and it is a bacteria that basically reproduces itself in cats. Yeah. And it comes out in cat feces, and because rats and mice are often around feces, they get toxoplasmosis. And what that does to them is it changes their behavior so they're more likely to get eaten by cats. And when they get eaten, the toxoplasmosis leaves the rat flesh, goes into the cat's body, and then reproduces. It's a cycle. So you have those two things, and the 1968 kind of like prologue gets into Cordyceps a little bit to help you understand that this is the kind of thing that could really happen. And I think, again, that idea that if the Earth got warmer, then fungus would have to adapt, and that's what we're dealing with. That was tight. That was a tight way. Tight way. Andy, what's up with the girl with all the gifts?
Okay, so I will say that there was another movie that tackled this same cordyceps as a vector point for infection to create a zombie-like creature. And it was called The Girl with All the Gifts, 2016 movie. It's based on a book. And both The Girl with All the Gifts and The Last of Us, Neil Druckmann's The Last of Us, were inspired by a very specific segment of a very specific program. It was Planet Earth, David Attenborough's BBC Wildlife nature series, Planet Earth. And there was a segment in that show called that where David Attenborough highlighted Cordyceps and its impact on insects. And there was like a chilling line at the end of that little segment where he shows the effects of cordyceps on ants, on grasshoppers, on walking stick bugs. And he talks about how cordyceps has adapted itself to like each of these individual insects to specifically alter their behavior. And there was a line, I think, at the end of that where he implies that if that were to happen to humans, the basically the same effects would happen to us as well. But obviously, at this point, it's impossible for cordyceps to alter themselves. But I think that little segment, chilling little segment, inspired both Neil Druckmann and the author of The Girl with All the Gifts. And I remember when I saw that cordyceps segment, I also got a chill down my spine because I had the same sort of, I had the same extrapolary thought, like, oh my God, this, we're just for the, you know, for, you know, if it were for just, you know, a few evolutionary changes, we'd be suffering the same fate. So, in our show notes, I'm going to, embed that video from that Planet Earth episode, and you can see for yourself what's going on.
Also, there's this little game called Last of Us. I'd say suggest checking it out if it's something that you're interested in. And you'll actually notice we didn't talk too much about all the Easter eggs, but there's quite a lot, from sound effects to I think Andy mentioned some of the text, but other sign placements, the color and highlight of certain things visually. So if you want a little bit of a deeper analysis, you can always play through that game while you watch the series.
I'll embed also the watch through that I'm watching as well. So if you want, but do know that you'll probably have the series spoiled for you if you've never played it, because it seems to be pretty faithful. So if you want to sort of see where the source material, where all this comes from, I'll embed the playthrough. All right. I think that is going to do it for this episode of Quarantine Zone. I'm going to go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Dwayne. I'll ask, where can people find your work on the internet when you're not talking about The Last of Us?
You can check me out on Twitter. I'm not doing a ton of things on the internet, but that's where I am right now. I think you can find me on Mastodon, but I don't even know how to find me on Mastodon, so good luck. Tosin, what about you?
Yeah, you can catch me on Twitter for now. Not really doing much there, Toast4321, but I will also be creating a Mastodon and making that accessible and sharing some of my stuff on Instagram as well, too. So maybe we'll have different ephemera in the different where you can find us in the future for you.
And for myself, my Twitter is Mr. Babyman. That's my Twitter handle. And you can find everything that I'm liking and linking there. And otherwise, be sure to add us at Twitter at QZPod. And tweet us, write us an email, drop us a comment on iTunes. And we will see you next week when we cover the second episode of The Last of Us, which is entitled Infected. Very ominous title. So that's it. We'll see you guys next week.